My heart is calm, my sorrows ended. No longer bound to I learned to listen to my suffering and to the suffering of when understanding is born in me, compassion is also
this is the second day of our day. No, this is the second full day of our retreat. Taking a look at the Anapanasati Sutra. Getting very sensitive to their feelings. Just a couple of announcements. There are two people who had to leave the retreat early. One, Lynn, had a friend who was terminally ill and actually went into the dying process last night. So she was wanted to be there with her. So she was called and she left early. And another woman, Cheryl, who has chronic back condition, found it just too painful even to sit in a chair. She's had to leave so she could get treatment. But she wants everybody to know that she's been having a wonderful experience. Obviously, I will not be able to get to all the questions. That's why we have. And if there are still a few openings, if I don't get your question today, please go to Bill's consultation. he wants to do more outdoor walking meditation in the morning evenings, you're getting your chance because that Wednesday daylight savings time. So those of you who are night people and have difficulty getting up in the morning, you can imagine that the tonight's session will end at 8:30 a.m. up here. So therefore, you have lots of time this evening to enjoy the outdoors, walking, sitting. Please take advantage of it. And for those of you who have trouble staying up, but are morning people, you can go to bed earlier tonight and get up and have more time in the morning. You have an extra hour, so it's prayers are being answered. let me just say something about sitting meditation. Many people find it difficult. And many people find it difficult not just for the physical, but I think even more so for the mental. We are not at ease in our bodies, and we are not at ease in our minds. Not a movement. Is there something going on that I don't know about? But... Oh, passing bread. You know, I'm kind of speaking. Is the speaker being moved up? You're having trouble? Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Uh-oh. How is that? Is that better? Okay. So just keep telling me. So sitting meditation, it is again, it is something that many people find difficult. Okay, we are not at ease in our bodies, and we are not at ease in our minds. We don't like being with ourselves without something to distract us for extended periods of time, and that's just the truth. We sit with expectation, and when we don't meet our expectation, we often feel frustrated or disappointed. We don't like those. We don't like those feelings, do we? Also, since we are so addicted to activity, it's very easy for us to get bored. And I could go on and on and on. I think through this practice of the Dhamma, you will discover many wonderful things. So, sitting, learning to sit without moving. And to find ease of body and mind within yourself without needing any external stimulation to produce those mind things. I think in the long run, you will find incredible benefit to you. But it will not come immediately, and it will not come without some discomfort, pain, physical and emotional. One has to be committed to the process. One has, you know, it's what we said yesterday. One has to have confidence and trust. I think there is just so much to learn in sitting. You know, it's the end of the road, guys. You can run, but you cannot hide. It is even sitting and sitting. Eventually, you'll get sick of your own fantasies. You'll get sick of your own drama. You'll get sick of your own whining, your own confabulating. And that's good. They say in the program, sick of being sick or something like that. Sick and tired of being sick and tired of them. It's something like that. And when we get to that point, we'll want to, there'll be more energy wanted to do it differently. So even though I understand, you know, I began in a tradition, I spent 6 years in a Zen tradition, all you did is sit. And that was the practice. And you can move, you're not allowed to move, and you know, it was very difficult practice, very physically and emotionally painful practice. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody. I know that that kind of practice takes its cost on many people. But when I look back, I think it was very positive for me, because it forced me to face myself. There was no escape. And, you know, if you're up for it, it's good. Again, I think there's a way to do it. It doesn't have to be that rigorous. It doesn't have to be that fierce. I think the amount of sitting that we do in our tradition is not excessive. Those of you who've been to other types of retreats, more traditional retreats, know that. But having said that, you know, to develop a seat for yourself where you can sit with yourself, with your body, with your mind, with your emotions, at ease, comfort. Without a struggle, without a fight, without recrimination, without frustration, without disappointment, without, you know, drama. I think you will find that a great benefit. Also, extended periods of sitting, also of stillness. You know, there is a reason. There's a reason the Buddha sat that way. And there's a reason that so many Buddha images are shown in the meditation posture. Because there is something in the stillness that allows you to look deeper and deeper and deeper. There is no kind of external stimulation going on, either physical or mental. And so it's, if you're interested in looking deeply into your mind, into your nature, and experiencing deeper levels of the mind, again, sitting meditation has always been very central in the meditative process. I mean, having said that, one can have insights in you know in all postures, in all activity. If you read the enlightenment stories of the Zen masters, you see they were, you know, they'd be out working in the fields. And they would have insight. That's because their mind was always practicing. So I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not one of those who say only sit. But I am saying it's good to be able to sit with ease of mind and body, as well as you will develop ease of mind and body if you continue to develop your sitting practice. Is it possible to see, hear, touch, or feel without some thought, without discrimination? It is said that the Buddha is free of discrimination. In the kind of practice that we do as lay people, there will be the arousal of thought. And thought often is a type of, some types of thoughts are discriminating thoughts. So in our practice, because we are lay people, and again, we are active, and many of us are, you know, and we have a very thinking culture. We have lots of information, and many people earn their living, you know, processing various kinds of information, lots of information, you know, to hold up an ideal of being without thought, is probably totally unrealistic. But again, thought is not the problem. Right? It is our attachment to thought, it's our belief in that thoughts are giving us reality, which is the problem. So for those of you who are concerned about, you know, how will I ever be free of all these thoughts, I would say, key is in the word freedom. Freedom means that I am no longer enslaved to my thoughts. Thoughts put experience into words. That's what they do. Thoughts are not experience. Experience is alive. Thoughts are linear, they're one dimensional. And again, one can think anything, right? I mean, I can think this is what? I can think this is Big Bang. In the world of thought, right? I can label this anything. I could label this an avocado. I mean, I can think anything about this, can't I? But does that change the reality of what this is? No. This is still this. And I know this is this without thinking it. We can endlessly talk about what this is, and we could have 45 different opinions, and we go on and on. This doesn't change this. So you've got to decide, where would you rather live? In the world of thought and discrimination, or in the world of reality? It's a choice. It doesn't mean, in terms of social whatever, we don't have discussions. We don't share our thoughts, our beliefs, or ideas. But we know those are just hypotheses about reality. It's not the same as reality. So what's the big deal? Why do we get so bent out of shape? Why do we get so upset? It's kind of silly, isn't it? Again, in Buddhism, right thought is part of our path. But those are thoughts that are in concurrence with reality. Really has to do with what's called right view. Seeing things correctly. So with this impermanence, I don't see permanence. With this non-self, I don't see self. With this suffering, I don't see happiness. As we said earlier, that's delusional, but that's a thought disorder. It's a view disorder. We don't see clearly. We see delusively. So in Buddhism, especially when you get into the philological and philosophical, the ability to correctly attribute to an object correctly, you know, its correct attributions is part of, monastics or whatever who study Buddhist logic get into all this. But I think it's very good kind of training, you know. And as lay people, are my words truly reflective of a perceived reality, or is it just my own projection? Now that'll shut us up. We don't like that. We like to be just screwing our projections all over the place and treat them as if they're real and wanting everybody else to treat them as if they're real. But they're just our projections. You know, not only do we keep this stuff going inside of us, but we just spew it out. You know? No wonder the world's a mess. So it's very important to know what things are and to be able to label a thought, a projection, a mental formation, an emotion, a sensation, a memory, past, present, future. This is just my view. This is my thought. At least you need to qualify things a little bit. This is not the truth. This is just my belief about things. Take it for what it's worth. You know, we need a little humility. But it comes from understanding that these are just thoughts, these are just beliefs, they're not real. When I talk about my past, Am I talking about an accurate picture of every moment that has ever happened to me in my memory? No, it's selective. It's distorted. I've cherry-picked. And depending on kind of your personality, you're cherry-picking it toward the positive side, you're cherry-picking toward the negative side. You know what I mean? We all have a case we're trying to prove. We're all like lawyers, you know. We have our case material in terms of our life that we're trying to present. But to think that we're actually giving someone an accurate picture of what has transpired in our life, no, we haven't. Again, we could go on. But it's, you know, watching the mind. It's very helpful. And when you spend time just observing your own mind, your own experience, and spend time just observing the minds and experience of others, just observing, you'll learn a lot. Yeah, that's all the Buddha did. He didn't take courses at the university. He didn't go to the self-help section, Barnes & Noble, and, you know, read up on every issue. He didn't have access to the internet or to... What did he do? He just observed reality. But he observed very keenly. He looked deeply. What's really going on here? And that's where his wisdom came from. I say that only because each of us have that same capacity. We have to be willing to be objective observers. Really, isn't that, for anybody here, a researcher, isn't that the first criteria? We need to be objective observer of phenomena. So that's, in a certain way, we could say that the Buddhist methodology is the scientific methodology. Tell us more about breathing joyful and happy. Tell us about the joy of practice. Sounds like somebody here could do that. Let me just say this for Vedana. And we'll talk about positive feelings. The book explains the relation between joy and happiness, but what are the differences between calm, ease, relax? These are words. These are words, aren't they? And if I say calm, ease, relax, and Charlie says calm, ease, relax, and who knows what we're talking about the same thing. You know, when you're talking about felt experience, it's very personal. I mean, early on in my career as a psychotherapist, I realized I was using words, and the person across me was nodding, and I knew that they had no idea what I was talking about. And also, I could refer to things, but if they hadn't had that experience in their life, they would be accessing a totally different felt experience for the word I'm using that may mean something totally different to me. So, calm, ease, relax. You got me? Yeah, we use the words, don't we? Words are pointers. Calm, ease, relax. We know enough English. We all speak English here. So we know enough English to know where those words are pointing at. Please go to where those words are pointing. And have your own experience. Oftentimes we get there because we understand the opposite more clearly. Oftentimes these kind of words we may not even know. But we know what it means to be riled up. We know what it means to be agitated. We know what it is to be in discomfort. So just take all those away. What's left? What's the opposite? If I let go of being ill at ease, then what would I be? If you're somebody who's ill at ease in a social situation, if you weren't ill at ease, how would you be? If you're somebody who never experienced calmness, We say, oh, the waters are calm. What does that mean? Not a lot of waves. It's calm. It's clear. Oh. And I look at my own mind. Is my own mind calm? Not a lot going on. It's clear. It's not murky. Like that. So I think these are good questions, but don't look for word answers. Do you know what I'm saying? Don't be satisfied with words. You want the experience. Right? So go, what does it really mean to be calm? To have a calm body, have a calm mind, to be at ease. Don't look around. Because, you know, we say, oh, today, we might say, oh, it's a pretty calm day today, isn't it? Looking outside. It's a calm day. Things aren't blowing about. There's not a lot of noise. Oh. I'm going to check in my mind. Is there not a lot going on? Nothing blowing around? It's calm inside. I'm having difficulty letting go of the energy that propels me forward to projects, planning, creative ideas. You say that living in the future is a sickness of the mind and it is suffering, but it doesn't seem so. It feels good and produces good results. Well, again, if your orientation is to produce good results, so be it. I'm not going to argue. Again, we can look deeply. You just watch yourself and you see if living in the future produces happiness for you. If you look at your life and you see if always planning and having expectations produces happiness for yourself. If it does, you have your own dharma. Market it. Get it out there. But if the Dharma is true, you will see that there is something in that way of thinking and living that ultimately produces dissatisfaction. That's all. So it's not to say in life there aren't many things that produce temporarily a sense of happiness. Obviously, you know, the 8 worldly dharmas. One of the worldly dharmas is what? When I feel successful. When things work out my way. So, if I plan something and it works out my way, I will be temporarily happy, of course. But on the other side, if I plan for a bit of expectation and it doesn't work out my way, I will be what? Unhappy. Then I'm happy, unhappy, happy, unhappy, happy, unhappy. And that's called what? Normal life. That's all. And that life is what the Buddha walked away from. That's all. You know, Buddhism doesn't say, you know, one cannot find all kinds of happinesses in ordinary life. One can. But the Buddha said they're all temporary and they're all conditional. That's it. Okay, so please understand. there are people, hermits, people who walk away from the whole thing. Right? We're not working. You know, that's not us. Right? We are very still much engaged in life, so we're not going to walk away from the whole thing. So what we have to do is in this world, where we do have to do a certain amount of planning and, you know, things like that, to be able to do it with enough ease and enough intelligence and a lack of clinging, a lack of grasping, etc., that it doesn't become a source of suffering to us. That's the key. You know, can I plan knowing that I'm just fantasizing, that something's going to turn out in some way. So I am not attached to it being successful or not successful. Right? So Dharma can help us live within what's called the eight worldly dharmas, the ups and downs, back and forth, pain and pleasures of life, without it becoming any way deeply upsetting or disturbing or becoming a significant kind of suffering. We do it because we can see clearly, we can see deeply, and we can be non-attached to outcome. Yeah, I mean, all of us have to do again, this is the Franciscan Center. I would imagine St. Francis of Assisi didn't do a lot of planning. But he was a saint. He lived with the birds. You know, right? I remember reading his biography years ago, and he lived a very simple life, and very wonderful. Most of us are not living with the animals and the birds, are we? But that's the truth. So there's a question about intensive. When we answer, we'll answer that one tomorrow. And last but not least, somebody's having trouble prostrating to the bodhisattvas. Feel uncomfortable because maybe of their religious background or their ego. Maybe it might be my religious background or my ego. Could be both. I don't know if I usually say in the opening evening, and maybe I forgot that time, as a question. I usually, when I talk about the chains, arrows, and prostration, I usually say, but always do what you're comfortable. I mean, you know, if you don't feel like bowing, if you don't feel like prostrating, that's fine. I mean, this is not that kind of organization. This is not kind of spiritual group where things are orthodox or have to be. But at the same time, you might be, if you have trouble, you may be curious about it and wonder, what is it about? To me, it's always curiosity, and whether you engage with it intellectually to find out what it's about, or you just try it out. I mean, to me, the best thing is just try it out. See what it's like. You know, you may be surprised that it's not what you thought it was. Many of us continually have that experience, don't we? That we have our thoughts about life, thoughts about people, thoughts about the future, and yet reality unfolds quite differently than our thoughts. Buddhism comes from Asia. In Asian culture, it was very common to prostrate. To the Han, they call it now touching the earth, but it's just a nicer way to say it. It's a prostration. And in Asia, it was very common to prostrate, not just in temples. I mean, people would prostrate before what? Before the High Lord, before the King. In India, children take the feet of their parents, of elders, very common. You still see it today. Or somebody who's high up. People go down and touch their feet. It's just a sign of what? Respect. So this is respect, an everyday respect. A prostration is just deeper respect. So that's really the origin of prostrations. Obviously, people who follow the Buddha's way have deep respect for the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And so therefore, the tradition of bowing, prostrating, to show deep respect to the altar, very traditionally, with my teachers, always prostrated before my teachers when I came into presence. Just a tradition. It's a nice tradition. I'm not again, because I've practiced in more traditional traditions where it's the way. So to me, prostration is a very beautiful thing. It's just very, just to get down and just touch the earth. I think it's a wonderful kind of mudra in and of itself. My first teacher, Philip Kaplow, in the Zen tradition, used to say his take on prostration was he said it lowers the mask of ego. Most of us were like this. know, it's interesting. Somebody asked me a question. When I first heard it, you know, that one of where the, you know, Sangha goes to the river, and you know, beyond the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex. I'm sure, I'm surprised nobody asked me about that one. But people go, well, that would, you know, because in our society, it's like, and again, it's a translation. I mean, I have no idea what the Vietnamese is because I'm sure it's not the same. But you know, we know superiority complex, we have no inferiority complex. People have never heard of the equality complex. If anything, it sounds good, right? But it's interesting. What it means is those are all three different kind of ego states. Right? One is what? Arrogance. You know, I am superior to everybody. Two, taking the lesser. I am less than everybody. Right? So we can understand how those are ego states. But this is also an ego state. You know, I'm equal to everybody. Right? Which is also not true. Some people know more than me, some people know less than me, some people are better athletes than me, some people less perfect, some people have more money than me, right? Some people get in first, some people, you know, some people are in the front of the line, some people are back of the line, right? Mm-hmm. I don't go to the front of the line and go, Susan, you know, I'm equal to you, why should you be first in line? Right? See what I'm saying? That's the equality complex. Hey, how come Angie's over there ringing the bell? How come it's me to ring the bell? Right? So that's the equality complex. You see, it's not like, you know, I should ring the bell because I'm better than Angie. You see, but I should ring the bell because I'm equal to Angie. So it's just another way that the ego manifests. What were you talking about? I don't think. Oh, frustration. That's right. So again, it's that, you know, why should I have to prostrate myself, you know? But again, you know, getting down on the ground is very, you know, there's a lot to let go of in that. And again, I'm not saying that anybody has to do this. Because it's very personal. But to really in this life, whether it's a spiritual path, whether it's a teacher, and not just a spiritual teacher, you know, just someone who's a teacher, a master of whatever. But to find these kinds of people in one's life, to have these kinds of people in one's life, and to deeply love and respect. And to be quite overtly willing to show that, I think is a wonderful thing for us. You know, in this life, we don't find that many things, right, that are so worthy of respect. There's so much integrity. You know, I think we're used to always being disappointed, right, let down. Let down by our parents, let down by our teachers, let down by our politicians, let down by our leaders. You know, we are constantly used to being let down. And I think we're very leery of kind of giving our love and respect to something. Speaking personally, I can only speak for myself, and I've been involved with the Dharma for over 40 years. I have found it fearless. I have found it an object worthy of respect. And that's so wonderful. That's why I have such deep respect for it. And I have no problem prostrating myself before representatives of it, whether just in art or whether in living form. Hopefully, everyone here, during the course of their life, will find things in their life that they feel are worthy of respect. And you will be happy showing that respect in any way you can. So before returning to the sutra and the part we were in, five hindrances and the arhats and the non-returners and the once-returners and the three-time returners and the stream enterers and all that good stuff, which I find very interesting. Let me talk a little bit about the dana, the sensations, that which we're dealing with today. And again, for those, I mean, people are in the intensive on this. We have 16 meditations, and we're focusing on one a week. Here we're doing, you know, four a day. So we're doing this in this way, in this very brief way, just so people can get used to these practices and have an opportunity in this environment to practice them. But this is a lifetime of practice and learning. So please don't misconstrue that we're only doing it for a day, like that's all it's worth. This is like introduction, okay, demonstration. In the sutra, in the second tetrad, dealing with feelings, interesting enough, even though the Buddha calls it the tetrad on feelings, that they all deal with feelings, the dana, it's actually the first two deal with training oneself in, as one breathes in and out. In the first one is in being aware of, we could say, it's translated rapture, bliss. And the second one is sukha, or happiness. The third meditation, breathing in and out, I'm aware of the mental processes that are conditioning my feelings. And the fourth is I calm the mental processes that are conditioning my feelings. Those are the four. So it's interesting that the actual feelings that the Buddha mentions as feelings are rapture, bliss, and happiness. Well, we know there's a whole range of positive and negative and neutral feelings, so we might wonder about that. I certainly wonder about that. I think part of the answer is that the Buddha was given these teachings in the context of retreat with his monastics. It was a meditative retreat. They were on the rainy season retreat for 3 months. Now he had a fourth month. And it is the expectation that there will be a natural progression when one does the meditation, when one calms and stabilizes and unifies the mind, that naturally positive feeling states will arise. This has always been the experience of meditators, not just in the Buddhist tradition. And so what the Buddha is saying is, having developed this calm, clear, unified, concentrated mind through focusing on the in-breath and the out-breath, through focusing on the body, through calming the body, the next thing one would notice in terms of feelings would be what? These positive mind states, pleasurable mind states. And so he's saying, become aware of that has arisen within you as you breathe in and out. So it is a natural progression which can go on in one meditation session. Right? Again, let's not get carried away with bliss and rapture because it sounds very extreme. But I don't think it is. The first one is really when you have a blister and you've been wearing these shoes that are causing you to blister. When you take off those shoes, how do you feel? Ah. Okay. It's that kind of happiness. Okay? I think the first kind of happiness is the happiness that is in relationship to some kind of difficulty or suffering. And when there's relief from that, there is this kind of happiness arising. If you're very thirsty, if you're dying of thirst and you drink water. Like that. Again, you know, we could go through lots of examples, but that's that kind of happiness. But it's usually conditioned on the unhappiness beforehand. So in the same way, I think in our practice, our meditation, when things begin to quiet down, things begin to calm down, things begin to stabilize, there's a kind of happiness, kind of a blissful, happy state that arises. And it's very pleasurable, but we want to grasp at it. Why do we want to grasp at it? Because we don't want to go back there. We didn't like that. We like this. Right? And so, on the one hand, having those kinds of experiences in one life, based on the practice, to feel some happiness, spaciousness, expansiveness, from the practice, is good. It shows that we're practicing. It shows that our practice is deepening. But on the other hand, the danger there is it. Our practice then just becomes like an escape mechanism. It's like if this is set off against that. We don't like that. We like this. I want to stay here. I don't want to go back there. The problem is, and this is why did you know that the Buddha rejected transabsorption? It's very interesting, you know. I think it relates to what we're talking about. The Buddha, after he left the palace, he spent a number of years visiting the major meditation teachers in his part of the world. That was accessed by foot, by the way. It was not too big a one. And basically, what he experienced in their practices were what's called the jhanas, or the absorptions. They were basically trance states of deepening based on single point of concentration that would take people into very blissful states of awareness. But what the Buddha experienced was the happiness, pleasure, bliss that was experienced was conditioned by remaining in that trance state. It did not carry over. And so therefore, it did not carry over into all this. How do you deal about all this? Right. So he rejected it. Even though we know he was the top of his class. And according, if you read the accounts, these teachers saw like he was, you know, an incredible meditator. Would experience all these things, and the teacher would say, "Stay with me, you know. I, you'll be my first, you know, you're my best disciple. I'll, you know, and I will make you my heir." But he rejected that. He had enough sense to know that what he was looking for was not conditioned, was not a conditional happiness based on an achievement of a certain state that was subject to regression. And you know that after many, many years of practicing this way, he then went on a period of asceticism. Do you remember that? So that was like another very common path in India at that time. You know, the self-mortification, kind of coming and enlightenment through denying the body and mortifying the body. You know, transcend the body. And we know that he was near death, if you remember, because he was down supposedly eating one grain of rice a day. I mean, that was his latest path. And if you go to India today, you will see still many sadhus or whatever practicing the path of self-mortification. And people, you know, make offerings to it. But there's people all kind of contorted poses and this and that, and things stuck through them, and, you know. And if you go to any kind of Hindu holy spots or a place like that, or temples, you'll often see sadhus like that, and people will be offering them money. Actually, they'll be actively asking you for money, the way it operates. But so that's still operating today. So very interesting. The Buddha is near death, very weak from this path of asceticism. Interesting. Somebody said yesterday they were outside and they had experience they hadn't had since they were a child, and remember, it's like the spaciousness. The Buddha, very, very debilitated, has a memory. This is very important. He has a memory of when he was a teenager. Do people know the story under the rose apple tree? So he's a teenager, and he is at the, it's like the harvest. Well, maybe it's not the harvest. Because they were plowing, so maybe it was a spring festival. So he's at the spring festival, and there's a lot going on. You know, people are celebrating, but part of it is they're running the oxen and the plows through the fields, and he's absorbing all this hullabaloo and all this going on, you know, because it's a celebration. But he's also noticing that as the oxen are pulling the plows through the field, animals, small animals, are running in fear for their life. They're being sliced up. He's kind of seeing what's going on there. And we know that he then, in this state of kind of consternation, he goes off by himself. And he sits under a tree. And under that tree, he just kind of, you know, goes with whatever that meant. He just kind of lets that situation has disturbed him enough that he gets away and he goes, sits down, and he just goes within himself. And we know that he had some kind of deep meditative experience that filled him with peace. Right. But it was not conditioned on a trance. It was conditioned on looking deeply into this whole impermanent change, you know, what was going on in the external world. He looked deeply into that, and he found some place of resolution deep within himself. And supposedly, at that ecstatic period when he was so near death, he remembered that. And he remembered how wonderful he felt. And that is what kind of called him back, that he realized, I just kind of accidentally bumped into something when I was a teenager on my own, and it felt better than anything I've experienced, either following the path of trance absorption or following the path of asceticism. Very interesting. And it was at that point that he decided he would start eating again. The path of asceticism does not work. It was at that point that he took food from the cow maiden, Sujata, and that his ascetic colleagues left him in disgust that he had kind of sold out. I say this because one, over time, should expect, if one is practicing sincerely and if one is practicing correctly, and not just only in formal meditation, but throughout the day, that one will begin to experience more happiness, more joy, more peace, more positive feelings in one's life. Now, having said that, we also know that there is a tradition in Buddhism called joyful effort, the cultivation of joy. And we know if there is anybody who is the exponent of that in our modern age, it is Thich Nhat Hanh. Yes. He's kind of found that vein in the Buddhist tradition, and he's really mined it. As anybody who has read his books, been to his retreats, know he does a wonderful job with that. Not only in his teachings, but also just the way he is. And he has really taken that vein in Buddhism, and he's just expanded. And I think he's expanded it because he understands people are so unhappy these days. And that, I mean, I've never thought about this, but I'm just guessing now. But I think having grown up in a kind of agricultural, rural, intact culture, the way he did in Vietnam, where there was still great beauty, ceremony, family, you know, there were still many, 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 many things that supported happiness and joy in life. Right, and in the culture, that I think to see what has happened in the last 20, 30, 40 years, and how the culture that we have developed is so joyless, and family life is so joyless, and relationship life is so joyless, and culture, you know what I mean? That I think he's taken that vein, and he's kind of brought it right here. To the center of practice, and so therefore, when you read him, you get this very clear, we need to very consciously cultivate experiences that produce happiness and joy and beauty. Because I think, my sense is, it was always there in the Buddhist tradition, but again, because of what has occurred culturally in our modern age, and so many of those things are no longer present, that we have to be much more consciously bringing them in. Now that is Fred, second fact. But anyhow, so take it for what it's worth. But the bottom line is, we do have this emphasis that we can take pleasurable, you know, the three. We can take pleasurable events, experiences, and we can amplify them. Why? To nourish the mind. To nourish the mind. To nourish the body mind. You know, in the four nutriments, teachings on the four nutriments, we know that food is only one nutriment, and for a healthy body, the nutriment has to be good. Right? Or we won't have a healthy body. If our nutrition is devitamized, processed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we will not have a healthy body. Or if we eat stuff that has no nutritional value, i.e. junk food, again, we are not cultivating well-being in our body. In the same way, we have to be very conscious in terms of how we consume the kind of nutrients that we're taking into our senses and our mind. So we can very consciously, much more consciously than the past, go about having experiences that nourish our minds, our emotions. Is that clear? So, you know, the cultivation of happiness, the cultivation, you know, so therefore, we see Thich Nhat Hanh takes, if you read his book, or if you've been on his retreats, you know, he takes awareness of the body, which very traditionally was always just being aware of the body, aware of the body parts, and he adds what? Smile at it. Or do a little reflective meditation where you think about your feet and those poor guys down there, you know, are always supporting us and taking that beating. They never ask for anything, you know? Right? And stop being and expressing gratitude for our feet, for our eyes, for our ears, for the sense. You see what I'm saying? So he takes, you know, for our heart, for our liver, you know, all these things we don't acknowledge. So we take something that was traditionally just an exercise in awareness and turns it into an exercise of cultivating happiness and well-being through gratitude, appreciation. I think this is very essential. You know, if you find that your mind is not happy, it may not mean that you're always dwelling in unhappiness, miserable states. it may mean that for some of us, but it could also mean that we're just spending our time in neutral. Right? You know, couch potatoism, surf browsing. I mean, a lot of that is just neutral time, right? At the end of which, you know, we're having lots of experiences, but at the end of which you're saying, you know, did those experiences really nourish you? You'd probably say what? No. Was it an overtly negative experience? You'd probably say no. It was neutral. So again, if you look at your day, if you look at your life, if you look at your work, and if it's not, you know, if it's mostly neutral to negative, right? Well, no wonder there's no happiness. No wonder there's no joy in us. So consciously being aware, I need to bring in those kinds of experiences. Now, it's very interesting because on the side of those that are pleasurable, like let's say taking a mindful walk along the river, right? Many people, that's pleasurable. So doing that very consciously, being very aware of it, is very nourishing. So there may be many experiences, being with certain people, you know, I mean, there may be, you know, meditating, reading down the books, being with Sangha. I mean, there may be many experiences that we can be aware of, that we could say, oh, these are positive experiences, pleasurable experience. I want to bring more of them into my life. But the other interesting thing is, the biggest deal is the neutral. You know, how can I begin to bring neutral experiences and bring them positive? So therefore, well, just coming back to the one we just did with the body scan turning to appreciation. Right? What before was just a neutral experience, by experiencing with some degree of appreciation, it all of a sudden becomes what? A positive, right? A pleasurable experience. So there are many things. I mean, I think the interesting thing about mindfulness is often by just paying attention, we realize we're going through our day on neutral because we are not noticing, we're not paying attention. And often just by looking, I mean, you might be, you may have colleagues, you may live with people, you may be very involved. And we're just going through the experiences on neutral. They're not joyful to us. They're just functional relationships. We're seeing each other, or, you know, what are you doing today? What are you doing today? You know what I'm saying? But we don't stop and take pleasure. We don't stop and look. We don't create interactions that create happiness. So, but I think, to me, this is the obvious one. You know, how can I amplify those things that are already pleasurable to bring them more in my life? So I am taking more of that positive nutrition into my mind. But the other thing is, how can I take all these things that I'm just kind of on, you know, automatic pilot about in my life, and using mindfulness and awareness and gratitude and loving kindness. I mean, talk about loving kindness, compassion. I mean, that, you know, just the act of in your own mind, thinking about people you care about, thinking about people you don't care about, and generating loving kindness, sending them compassion, right away takes, you know, what could have been just a neutral experience, and all of a sudden turns it into a positive experience. I mean, one can do that in the grocery store. You know, may you be happy. May you be happy. May you be free from suffering. So, you know, the capacity to increase our positive nutrition, our happiness nutrition, is always available to us. And on the other hand, you know, as we will learn on the negative side, the less that becomes obsessive for us, the less we make the negatives, a drama. So we are just feeding ourselves on negative energy, negative thought, negative emotions. Right? You don't have to. We can notice that there's a little aversion over here, but we don't have to make a story about it. We don't have to make a drama about it. We don't have to create emotionality around it. This is all having to do with what? Now, actually, the drama is actually in part in Tetrad 3, with the mind. Coming back to the purity of the second tetrad, we're just dealing with what I said this morning. Because this is the basis. We don't realize that it's the basis. Because we right away go to the story. But it begins very simply with that our senses, our mind makes a contact with something, and there is this positive, negative, or neutral response. And if we can just see that and learn to deal with it. Now, again, it's sort of like what I was saying earlier, when I was saying this morning about, sitting meditation, learning not to move and dealing with discomfort. Psychologically, how are people? Are you awake? Are you fine? What? Well, I'm warm too. You know, I don't think there's anything we can do, right? I mean, we can get mad at Ruth, but that wouldn't. I mean, because I remember Ruth was saying last night at a certain point, they said if you keep switching it back and forth, eventually it shuts down, which would really. We have two more for the day. Two more manual switches or something. Maybe we should just turn up the fans or something. You know, it's just an old system. I tell you, it's perfect for the practice we're doing. Maybe we can just amplify the fan, and if those of you don't like it, you can move away. Tell me. Is that better? As I say, I think if the system shut down, we would be. As you know, the system it just goes very quickly from being too warm to being too cold. It's very, I mean, that's just a system.
No equanimity.
So. Yes, that's good. So again, the practice of full awareness of the breath, the in-breath and the out-breath, the practice of awareness of the body, and the practice of becoming calm in the body is the ground. So typically, in that tetrad, we are doing what's called samatha. Calm abiding meditation. In the next tetrad, we're moving into what traditionally in Buddhist meditation is called Vipassana, they call it vipassana in the Sanskrit, vipassana. And that is typically called insight. Thay calls it deep looking. We are now beginning to investigate different. In the first one, we're just unifying, stabilizing, calming. The analogy being, you know, the sediment in the water has settled down. The bubbles, I use that example, the bubbles have settled down in the carbonated water, and now we can see. We can see, the water is clear now, we can see what's on the bottom. When everything was stirred up, we couldn't see anything. It was all murky. But through calm abiding meditation, things quiet down, things clarify, and now we can look. And that's what we're beginning to do. We are now, and this is why Buddhist meditation does not just stop in calming and quieting the mind. It is really to facilitate this most important next step, which is the cultivation of wisdom, understanding the nature of reality, understanding the nature of my true experience, what's really going on here. Right? You know, I know I'm all riled up, I have emotions, I get sad, I get happy, I get angry, I get scared, I get depressed, I get anxious, I get... You know, those are the effects that I feel. Right? But what's the cause? So this is why in Buddhist meditation, this deep looking. You know, Thay says he calls it stopping, deep looking. The rest of the Buddhist world calls it, but he also says samatha and vipassana. But that's what we're talking about. We're stopping so things can quiet and clarify, and then we're looking deeply. And the first thing in this sutra we're looking at is in this realm of feelings. Again, sensation feelings. And we are beginning to notice that as I go through the day, whether it's I'm seeing an object, hearing a sound, smelling an odor, tasting a taste, feeling something against my skin, right? Or perceiving something with my mind, a thought, a memory, whatever, I am having an immediate positive, negative, or neutral response. And again, if one can, in one's meditation, feel that, and one will begin to feel that, you will notice another way of looking at it is, the pleasurable, the positive is what I am willing to move toward. Right? I'll have another bite of that. Right? Oh, I'll look at these flowers. Yeah, I like looking at these. You know what I'm saying? Why when we look around do we stop here? Because there's something pleasurable that immediately grabs. We don't even know that's what's going on. You know, and why have I passed by everything else? Because at that moment, I'm having a neutral response to it. So I'm having a pleasurable response. Right? In the same way, I could be having a negative response. I could take a bite of something. Breakfast, what was it? It wasn't the pancakes. It was the other thing. The sausage. You know, but for those of us who've been vegetarians for 40 years, it's like, meat. You know? And it was very, very interesting. The actual taste wasn't bad, but the associations, you know what I mean? There was something, it was immediately negative, and I just had to, anyway, we don't need to go. but it's like that, you know, it's like immediately, and we could go to the story. You know, we'd immediately go to the story, ooh, it tastes like meat or whatever it is, meat or something, but we don't realize that before there's even the story, there is a negative sensation at the point of contact. That's what's going on. And that is then setting off a series of perceptive naming, labeling, and mental formation. It gets bigger and bigger. And it is usually here that we are dealing with things. The great gift in this practice, we learn within our own consciousness. We learn to deal with it right where it begins, to see that momentary movement toward, away, or just neutral. Again, coming back to the sitting meditation, why I say don't move. So you can watch that. Most of us just move. You know, we feel something right away, we move. We don't take the time to see what's really going on here. You know, at a deep level. What is the process? And is my need to immediately get away to something that is registering as negative, is that really so essential? Now, you may say, well, what's the big deal? I would say it is a big deal. Because we will see that tendency manifesting throughout our life. You know, it's interesting throughout our life. For example, many people are uncomfortable with negative emotions. Many people, let's take anger. It's a good one. Many people, when they are around other people who are angry, what do? As soon as they encounter somebody else's anger, they go what? Right away, escape, or else what do? They get anxious and they right away try to make peace. Calm them down. That's what they do to make them happy. You know what I mean? So, but the root of that is what? I'm not going psychologically. But I'm not going to the psychological yet. I'm just going, there's an immediate discomfort. And we're not present to that. We go to the story. We go to the reactive formations. Some people, it's also internal. When any kind of anger rises in them, first response is what? Don't want to feel that. So shut down, repress, act out, escape, sadness, anxiety, fear, loneliness, boredom, all these kinds of mind states that so many people are uncomfortable with and have developed very elaborate psychological behavioral mechanisms to not experience. Including addictions, including what? Food, shopping, TV, could be meditation, you know, if it's an escape mechanism. Lots of ways. This is why the Buddha rejected transabsorption as a path. Because he said it's a specific mindset that's being cultivated that it helps people get away from it, but does not give them the tools to deal with what's really happening. He said, I want liberation. Not liberation into a certain escapist, you know, trance-like state, but I want to be able to find peace, calmness, equanimity in the midst of the Dhamma. So his enlightenment is very different than others' enlightenment. You see, what do we say in the verses on the faith mind? Do not reject the sense domain. The sense domain, too, is enlightenment. So this practice is very... Today we are shifting this calm abiding, but instead using the calm abiding as the basis for now beginning to investigate the nature of our experience. Vipassana. Stopping, looking deeper. And again, you're having it all the time. I mean, this is something that you can just watch. Because, you know, your eyes are making contact, your ears, you know what I mean? When we talk about body awareness, right? The senses, organs, are in the body. They're included. The body is seeing. Body is hearing. Body is tasting. Body. Very wonderful practice. Keeps you on your toes. And the material that you will mine from this investigation, there is a stability that comes from samatha. There is a stability that comes from following the breath, being present to the body, calming the body. There is a stability and calmness that comes from that. But that's not what this is about. In Buddhism, the real calmness comes from wisdom, knowing the nature, the true nature of things. So again, the child can calm down from their nightmare when mommy and daddy come in and tell them everything's okay, mommy's here, daddy's here, go back to sleep. The child calms down. But when the child learns that the nightmare is just a dream, and dreams aren't real, then the child is no longer disturbed themselves by the nightmare. They have wisdom. They have understanding. They've seen into the reality of what a nightmare really is, and the peace that comes from that is different than the peace that comes from this. Is that clear? So this is very important. While the path of samatha, the path of calm abiding, is part of the path, definite part of the path, the cultivation of insight and wisdom, deep looking. And again, if you read Thich Nhat Hanh, he says this all the time. But this is what it means to practice. It's 12 o'clock. We never got to this sutra. Could you wait another day before hearing about the once returners and the three returners and five returners? You can't wait? No. Huh? You can wait. Maybe those who can't wait can stay here and I can tell you when those who can wait.
We get an extra hour.
So, a cup of tea. Positive. Look, positive. Positive. makes me want to do it again. But then what happens? Makes me hotter. Right? And that's what? Negative. Unpleasant. Dilemma. Right? Now this is dead serious. You know why? Let's take food. right? Mmm. Tastes good. Delicious.
Mmm.
Second one. Third one. Fifth one. Fifth one. Right? The effect. We forget about the one. Experience, right? We look at some food. That's really pretty, right? We like it. We'll take another one. You know how that is? Looks good. Smells good. Then halfway through the meal, we realize what? I'm full. What started out positive is now becoming negative. So our capacity to really be attentive to this is just in terms of our function, our well-being, physically, mentally, is very important. We know that the key component of all addictive behaviors is what? Short-term pleasure, long-term pain. I mean, it's a no-brainer. And yet we know that the addict always goes for what? Short-term pleasure. And gets into that spiral. Never wants to look at that one. Always wants to stay with this one. And that's why a lot of people overeat. It tastes so good. It's pleasurable feelings. Now again, if I don't have a lot of pleasurable feelings in my life, if I have a lot of neutral and painful experiences in my life, now the food is becoming what? The source of how I think I can get happy. Because we want to feel happy. We want happiness in our life. So we want pleasure in our life. But can you see how we're just going about it? In a long-term, very destructive way. This is why these teachings are so, I mean, it's interesting. Here we are, right? The few of us who gather to look at these teachings and these meditative practices, for the other 99% of the population seem fairly esoteric or far out And yet you see, they deal with the fundamental issues that so many people in our society are dealing with and have just no understanding of what's really going on, what's causing them to suffer, what's causing them to maintain these addictive spirals. And they have no capacity to understand there are so many other ways of finding happiness and well-being and ease of body and mind, which don't involve lots of self-destructive and meaningless kinds of activity. That's why you have somebody like Thich Nhat Hanh at 82 years old still running around the world, just giving the same message over and over again. 30 years later, he's just giving the same message to as many people who listen to him. As you see, it's just the vast level of suffering combined with the vast levels of ignorance. Ignorance, I'm not saying in a judgmental bad way, just that people are ignorant of the ways that they're causing their own suffering, combined with their ignorance of ways to create happiness and well-being for themselves, their bodies, their minds, their families, their relationships. These are difficult times in human history. So I can continue to drink the tea, even though it makes me warm. It feels good going down my throat. And the discomfort of the body warming up is not a source of suffering. is what it is. Could I make it a source of suffering to you? Of course. I could tell a story about it. Say, oh, I don't like the way I feel. Hot. But that's all going on in the realm of thought and perceptions. I'm amplifying what is just an ordinary event, which is my body is a little warm when it drinks the tea. I make it into a source of suffering. There is that initial negative point of contact, but I don't have to go with it. Right? If I understand that that's all it is just a little uncomfortableness in my body. That's all. And the third and the fourth meditation in the Tetrad on Feeling, where it talks about the relationship of feelings to mental processes, understand that there is a relationship. That feelings, sensations are conditioned by perception. Feelings condition perceptions, perceptions condition feelings. There is an interaction which can be noted. Why, again, since I'm a vegetarian, when I ate that faux sausage this morning, whatever it was, my immediate response was a little... Now, somebody who's here on a vegetarian retreat who likes sausage could be going, this is more like it, right? You see what I'm saying? The same exact taste. But it immediately registers with me negative, and sometimes positive. Why is that? Because also perception modifies feeling, too. Does that make sense? Can you see that? So it's very subtle, and we want to be able to see that. There's no truth to it. There are some immediate responses, but it's omitted its condition. Right. If I am a woman who was recently raped by a man, it could be that now, without even thinking, every time I see a man, especially let's say when I'm alone or somewhere, immediately negative. Right? Don't even think it's a negative. So again, the feeling is conditioned by a perception, and so I. That's a strong example, but it goes on and on. So there is in it the third and fourth meditation tell us as we breathe in and out to see how mental processes, which is here just really about perception, it's not mental formations, just how I perceive the event is also conditioning feelings. And then the fourth one is to calm. Breathing in and out, I calm the mental processes that are conditioning my feelings, and that calming again is not overtly, saying to myself, "Calm down, Fred." It's really simply by observing, not going with the story, just observing, simply what's going on. So I am aware that my body.
Would you say that the initial feeling wasn't unpleasant and neutral? That some are conditioned and some are not?
You'll find out. I like that. Please report back. You'll see. It's hard to say because, again, we're not newborn babes. One would think, caress, nice, positive, hitting, negative. But yet we know there are people who are called masochists, who may have the opposite response. Right? So we know there is, there is interaction. Because again, we are not... I'm sure there's lots of research in terms of newborns. psychology. I'm sure there is an endless volume of literature on those kind of innate positive negative responses, and there probably are. But I think at our stage, you know, we've had so many experiences. There's probably a fair degree of conditioning. But I think that's interesting to learn about ourselves. But even to acknowledge conditioning is to acknowledge that the reason I'm responding positively and negatively is totally conditional. There's nothing inherent. I mean, at a certain point, I guess, with pain or other kinds of afflicted things or being burnt with fire, I mean, there's certain things which are inherently, negative. But we know even in the realm of pain, there's incredible subjective capacity of human beings. Between male men and women, even, and things like that. So,
I was eating oatmeal this morning, cream of wheat. And there was an initial kind of bitter, almost stinging kind of sensation for me. So it was initially just negative.
A little louder.
Oh,
I'll just repeat it, because actually they've been asking me to do that for years for this thing. I never do it. So let's begin. Thank you. Thank you, Alan.
Getting a news.
Yeah. All right. So Charlie wants to tell us about his breakfast. And he was eating his
cream of wheat,
and he had a kind of a
bitter
taste,
bitter, almost sharp kind of taste to it. Mm-hmm. So it was unpleasant to me.
Unpleasant taste.
Right. So first inclination was just to stop, and the next thought is, am I allergic to this? Because I have had allergic reactions in the past. So there was just that initial bitter kind of sharp taste, which
is negative.
Negative, which I wondered if my cells were like reacting to the. Oh, and then there was the thought that it was an allergy.
Right, so he goes from immediately negative to then, because he's got a history of allergies, he's just going to set off an allergic reaction, and before you know it, he's having a full blown one.
Anxiety attack,
but we also know that he could be actually stimulating his allergic response,
right,
because of the body-mind connection. Yeah. So it is, I mean, there's lots of implications to this, because we know the body and mind are intimately connected, and these various, in the central nervous system, there are lots of places where these things come together.
Mm-hmm.
And so to say, what's setting this off, is very difficult to tease out.
You're right.
But I know you can tease it out. Just some deep observation. But again, as you can see, one can see how quickly, if one is not paying attention, how quickly one can get into the historical drama. Right? Which then will bring out the historical emotionality. I mean, depending on how we're wired, it can happen immediately, and it can become full blown, or it could take us 30 minutes to work out it to get it to that point. And yet, the truth is, all we know is what something was a little bitter in my cereal this morning, and I really have no idea what it is. I feel fine, actually, Donna. But we might not even know that we feel fine, because we're just in that story where I'm, already in the emergency. Right? I mean, so that's what I'm saying. This practice of attending to the Dhamma is so beneficial psychologically, behaviorally. But it takes concentration. It takes the capacity to stay present over time to what's arising, and to be willing just to watch and see without reacting. Again, same practice as before. Charlie catches himself. What's it doing? Relaxes. Smile, come back. comes back to baseline. And then goes back to enjoying his breakfast. Oh, I'm sitting here at the breakfast table eating cereal. But perhaps for the last 5 minutes, I haven't even been aware of it because my awareness has been in the drama. My emotional life has been in the drama. I'm feeling anxiety. I'm not feeling pleasure. But actually, the cereal wasn't bad. It could be neutral to pleasure based on how you like your cereal. But so again, this is very important. I mean, it is a meditative practice, but will give you great benefits and insights.
Are you suggesting that we, after we identify confidence and neutral, to try to transform the negative or the neutral into something more positive?
What I'm saying is it is a process. And what I would say to you is the first step is just getting skillful at identifying that this is what's going on. You know, I'll just say it again. If you look at this sutra, again, this is just my interpretation, and you know, there's lots of interpretations. I think there's a method to the Buddha's madness.
Okay.
He starts out that which is most concrete, most accessible, our physical body, our breath, right? Feelings, thoughts, perceptions, motions, you know what I'm saying? We're getting a little harder, getting more subjective. So let's just start out breath, body. Let's get grounded. Let's calm. Now, let's begin to explore the world of feeling sensations that we were talking about. Okay. Once we have a ground with that, and then you can see, oh, they're malleable. They're malleable. They're also, most of them are conditioned. Okay. And so therefore I can begin to remember, the Buddha's teaching is always about freedom. And stability. And we begin to realize when I'm lost in this world of reactivity unconsciously to this process of positive, negative, neutral, the stories around the condition, I'm not free. I'm just a reactive being. So begin to say, oh, but how about that one? And the eye is drawn to this one. But can I not turn that into a pleasurable experience? Or you would just pass it by, right? It's always interesting to see where the eye is drawn. We miss a lot because the eye is also conditioned to be drawn to certain things. You know, we can be in a whole room and a person walks in and right away we what? Maybe we look at them. Why? We're like monkeys.
You made about this painter play between perception and feeling. It's very interesting because there are lots of studies that show if you take a bunch of 2-year-olds, which really is great laboratory animals, and you give them sweet, bitter, and salty things, they're going to invariably choose the sweet and reject the salt and the bitter. And yet, over time, we come to appreciate salt and bitter because we've learned it. So it's something that's the game. You know, this is how it works.
And again, my understanding of Buddhist psychology, it was always experimental. I mean, it was not a theoretical model that then came into, you know, that then applied in reality, but it was a model that came out of direct experience and observation of the human mind and behavior. And so the fact that, you know, we would see concordance now between, you know, the 2,500-year-old psychology and modern kind of developmental studies and stuff like that should be. I mean, I think when you have people like Thich Nhat Hanh, Dalai Lama all saying Buddhism should accord with science. You know, there shouldn't be a conflict. Because if science is accurately depicting reality, and if Buddhist teaching is accurately depicting reality, there should be agreement. I mean, not in everything, you know, but generally. And you're right.
The awareness of the body, two different things occur to me, and I wonder if it makes any difference if one is more preferable than the other. One is that in going from a quiet breath to a very deep breath, feeling the body move, that's an awareness of the body, or just keeping a shallow breath and thinking about various parts of the body and becoming aware of them. And I'm wondering whether there's one is more preferable than the other, or what is it that's being referred to?
In which lines?
The one where it says you become aware of the body, breathe and attend to the body.
So before that, there are the lines about the short breath and the long breath. And again, my sense of how that has been interpreted for a couple of thousand years is it is not saying in the first one, you know, make your breath long, and the second one, breath, make your breath short. It's really saying observe how your breath is. Don't make it a long breath. Don't make it a short breath, but really be aware whether your breath is long, is short, is deep, is shallow, is slow, is rapid. Okay, so the one thing that it's very clear on is there is no in this practice there is no specific kind of breathing that one is trying to create. We are just simply observing and experiencing what is. Now, in the third one, which talks about awareness of the body, there seems to be two traditions. I mean, and they're not, they're not opposite one another. It seems like the general tradition is just body awareness, okay, where you're sort of just in the body, feeling the whole gestalt of sensation of being in a body, okay, from the toes to the head. Just kind of, it's sort of like you're just aware of the whole posture of being in a body. But then there's also a tradition where you're actually going through and being aware of each of your body parts, sort of like a body scan. I think generally, in terms of one's general meditation, I think the full body kind of makes more sense to kind of be the full body breathing. But at the same time, in terms of kind of cultivating and deepening relationship with one's body awareness, to do body scans, where one develops an awareness of all the parts of your body, may open up that capacity to be with the whole body. You know, because many of us, you know, we're just up in our heads, or we're just where we have aches and pains, but we don't have a capacity of really being present to the whole body. So I think for many of us, kind of doing the body scan over and over, so we develop that felt relationship, will then make it easier to kind of be present to the whole body. Last question. You open the door.
I didn't know.
No, it's okay.
I get good experiencing the neutral feeling as something, a place of clarity, of breath, between joy, pain, want, and being able to come back to it.
So somebody asked me that question. Now, my sense is it's not like, it's not exactly like that. Because, thank you. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You want to come in?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So the question is, I believe what you were saying was you're finding that kind of being just in that neutral place is very nice, feels very calming and peaceful. So, but that's not what this is about, okay? And other people have asked me that question. That's why I, in meditating on it, what struck me was it's really about those things, positive are things we want to move toward. Those things negative are those things we want to avoid, and those things neutral we're indifferent to.
Okay.
So that's what the neutral is. Because if being in neutral becomes the positive, then it's sort of like, we might as well just be, disinterested in everything, sort of blah, sort of, you know what I'm saying? Which is a kind of a danger, because again, there's so much of this up and down, back and forth, emotions, positive, negative emotions, and all that. We go, maybe just kind of being neutral is the goal here. But that's really not the goal. The goal is, as human beings, we do have positive feelings, we do have negative feelings, and we do have neutral feelings, and we want to be free in all those. That's why the answer is, how can I be experiencing positive, negative, and neutral feelings and not make a big deal about it, not make a big story about it, not get, big emotionality around it, but be able to enjoy being a human being, right, without the drama, without the story, without the extremes of emotionality. Does that make sense? So it is a calmness that is like this. In other words, it allows pleasure, it allows discomfort, it has the capacity of taking such, again, the danger of all these neutral feelings is we immediately get bored.
Yes.
we get bored, and if you have teenagers or children, they're bored because as soon as there's like things aren't happening, right? They may go, I'm bored. I need stimulation. Right? I need something positive or negative to keep me going. So what we want to be able to do is to go, no. The fact that you're bored is because you're not seeing that even in this neutral situation, there are opportunities for engagement, for being present, and for turning that quote unquote neutral experience into something positive.
Well, my quick example would be coming down on I-75,
mm-hmm.
looking in the rearview mirror, there's a big, Peterbilt truck wheel in my rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And
the immediate response is what? So she's saying she's driving down 75, there's a big truck right in her rearview mirror, immediate response is
anxiety, and then moving to neutral. Just saying, okay, there's a truck, I know what to do.
Yeah.
And that's, I just, was my perception of the mission.
Yeah, or it still can be there. I mean, it still can be a little, awareness of, but it's not becoming a story. It's not becoming, it's not affecting your emotion or behavior. It's still, the answer to me always is, if I said to you, would you rather that truck continue to be right on your bumper, or would you rather it not? And you would say, even though I'm not having an anxiety attack, I would want to move away from that one. So that's the answer. Okay. If we want to move away from it, we want to avoid, we want to avert, we want to get away from. Right? If we say, I want another bite, I'll have another bite of that. That's pleasure. If we say, I don't think I'll take it. I don't really want another bite of that. That's neither. If it's, I don't care. That's neutral. But we do care. We don't like the truck on our rearview mirror, do we? Thank you. Do we? Yeah. So it's subtle, can you see? And it's not about the story. It's about, again, move toward, move away, neutral. That's really. And we can see the moving toward leads toward grasping, clinging, attachment. This leads avoidance, escape, push away, aversion. You know, most people, that's their life, right? That's what they're always manipulating. And never understand when you look deeply into it. You don't have to go all the way out there. And again, this whole big thing in here, neutral, is just boring. Right? So this meditation is profound. I could say it's 12:30. Put it in the bell. But go see Brother Bill. So why don't we just, even though it's 12:30, why don't we just spend a minute just enjoying our body breath awareness. Thank you.